Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mr. Down for Whatever by L. Wright, narrated by Leon Nixon and Adenrele Ojo. The Untold Legacies, Mr. Black Organization. Every legacy has a story. This is ours. Nero. February this year. A legacy forged in fire and created with a vision for our future. My grandfather's words filtered through my mind as I stared at the African American Historical Museum before me. A cold chill crept up my spine. Despite the strides made, the triumphs shared, it almost felt like their efforts weren't enough. While I wouldn't discount progress, our communities were struggling to remain the vibrant beacons of light our elders fought so hard to build. Inspiration had yielded to influence. Social media had replaced face-to-face contact. Respect for each other seemed to be a thing of the past. "We shall overcome" became "it's all about me." Our elders were dying. The bridge to the past was buckling under pressure. I crept around the back of the museum. Before I arrived earlier, I'd studied the hand-drawn map for hours, memorizing the distinct script on the tattered page. My grandfather's writing. Levi Bond, better known as Ace. I was here today because of him, because of the urgency in his spirit that had propelled him to link up with a group of powerful men to form a secret brotherhood. The mission was as clear then as it was now: to uplift, to protect, to restore, by any means necessary. The groundskeepers had done a good job of maintaining the expensive lawn, making my trek easier. It took several minutes to get to my destination, just long enough for me to regret wearing a three-piece suit and a pair of Christian Louboutin shoes. But the directions on the map led me to an abandoned shack on the outskirts of the property, preserved through the community's efforts to designate this site a historical landmark. After glancing at my watch, I studied the structure. Traveling to this place served a dual purpose, and while I didn't mind getting my hands dirty, I had business to handle. My phone buzzed in my pocket. I answered. "Yeah, Ace." My grandfather's low voice came through the speaker. "Did you find it?" "I'm here now. Still not sure why you encouraged me to dress up if I had to walk a motherfucking mile in these damn shoes." The suit I didn't mind, but these damn shoes? I learned the hard way on my first day as a resident, wandering the halls at the University of Michigan Medical Center, that comfortable shoes were a necessity for my job. Ace laughed.
"Sometimes you have to get dirty to find the treasure. Remember that."
I grumbled another curse. "All right, I'll call you when I'm done with everything." I ended the call and made my way into the shack, using the trick my grandfather had shown me on the door. Luckily, his memory was impeccable because I was able to retrieve the case he'd stored there and make it back to the museum in record time. Dusting myself off, I made the short walk to the entrance of the underground bunker, the place where it all started. Decades ago, five men formed the Mr. Black Organization under the cloak of secrecy. Today, the organization had chapters in every state and members in every sector of society, from celebrities and professional athletes to clergymen and business moguls. To honor my grandfather's commitment, I joined the organization at 21, had remained a dues-paying member ever since. And while I respected the original mission of the organization, my career and my family had been my priority. Until now. As the current Mr. Black Detroit, I hoped to make impactful changes to my community and the organization during my time as the figurehead for our chapter. As I neared the meeting space, I glanced at the pictures lining the walls in the hallway. I paused at a black-and-white image of Ace, hanging on the wall, emerging from the shadows. The way he lives his life. The photograph was one I'd seen before many times, but seeing it there filled me with pride. I peered up at the man who raised me and felt the weight of responsibility on my shoulders, because I was the last Mr. Bond in his bloodline. Thankfully, Ace had brothers who had sons and grandsons, but Ace only had me, and I wouldn't let him down. I was so engrossed in my thoughts that I hadn't realized Preston was standing next to me. I eyed him out of the corner of my eye. "What's up?" I murmured, forcing my attention back to the present. Preston's gaze remained on my grandfather's portrait. "It's been a long time coming, huh?" The fact that all five founding members of the organization had legacies serving in Mr. Black roles for their respective cities wasn't lost on me. Dante Powell, Preston Scott, Titan Stone, Porter Crown. All of us tied by the bonds our grandfathers and great-grandfathers had made in this very room decades ago. "From my perspective, we should take this as a sign," Preston continued. "It's time to take this organization back to its roots." I observed the man next to me. Although Preston was younger than me, his serious demeanor reminded me of my grandfather. Intense, intentional, intelligent. We had that in common, so I was certain this meeting would be the start of something unforgettable. And I'm down for whatever is necessary. "That's what I'm talking about, brother." I held out a fist, and he bumped it with his. I followed Preston into the room and greeted Titan with a dap.
"What's good, man?"
"Same shit, different day," I grumbled, glancing back at Preston, who had his head buried in a book. "You good?" Titan waved a dismissive hand.
"Yeah, guy had me cracking up before you got here."
"How's the family?" I asked. Distance had limited interactions between the families, but we kept up with each other in various ways, usually off the grid.
"It's been a minute."
While Titan and I caught up, Dante arrived and joined the conversation. Soon the discussion veered into heated territory as we debated the current NBA season.
"I don't care what no one says. The Mavs should have taken it last year,"
Titan proudly proclaimed. I waved a dismissive hand.
"Man, please. Y'all Dallas fans have always been delusional."
"They're not the only ones. When Detroit makes the playoffs, maybe you can talk to me,"
Dante taunted.
"Better yet, why don't you just give it up and root for the winning team?"
As usual, Detroit stayed losing. But I was a diehard Pistons fan. I could and would talk shit until the day I died.
"That won't be L.A., so I'll gladly put my money on the Nuggets."
Dante grumbled a curse.
"Whatever, man. We got this."
"In your dreams," I retorted. Finally, Porter entered the room. Of all the gentlemen in the room, I'd interacted with Porter and his family the most, since Chicago was a mere 4-hour drive from Detroit.
"Nice of you to finally show the fuck up,"
Titan said, giving Porter a dap.
"You know me."
While all of us commented on his penchant for being late, Porter made his way around the room before he stopped at me.
"Good to see you, old man."
I chuckled. "Not too old to whoop your ass."
"How's your daughter?"
he asked, a mischievous glint in his eyes.
"Isn't she graduating from Michigan this year?"
My oldest daughter, Zoe, had followed in my footsteps and would graduate from the University of Michigan Medical School this year.
"Tread lightly, young brother."
Cracking up, Porter patted my back.
"I'm a man, and Zoe is beautiful."
"Beautiful and off limits to you." It was all in fun. I knew Porter wasn't serious. Even if he was, it wasn't going to happen because Zoe had been living with her girlfriend for 2 years now.
"Tell your father to get at me, though."
Preston cleared his throat, interrupting our conversation.
"Okay, let's get started."
He took out his tablet.
"As part of the founding families, we've all been members of Mr. Black since we turned 21. Yet it wasn't until I was attending the networking event this past October that I realized, for the first time since our grandfathers and great-grandfathers stood in this room, that each founding family has a member as the chosen Mr. Black rep for their city right now. It had been over 50 years, which was a damn shame. The brothers on the wall in the hallway had paved the way for the organization to exist and had slowly been pushed out as the tumultuous civil rights era gave way to Reaganomics and the pursuit of the almighty dollar. Somewhere along the line, money became more important than justice. Now, the erasure of our culture through various laws and political show threatened everything our forefathers had worked so hard to attain: the freedom to live.
"I suspected it had been a while," Titan said. "But I must have been so busy with work, I didn't realize this was the first time in over 50 years.
Preston nodded. "I don't think the National Executive Board realizes it either."
I thought back to something Ace had told me years ago. You don't have to care to be affected.
I recalled a moment me and Ace shared during one of the national meetings several years ago, when the conference opened with a popular rapper taking the stage and disrespecting black women. Ace was disappointed. As if that wasn't bad enough, Mr. Black Boise had given an impassioned speech about our community's reliance on welfare checks and food stamps. He implored us to turn away from our past oppression because racism had been eradicated in America. The man even stated the reasons why affirmative action had harmed the race. Before the speech ended, Ace asked me to follow him. We ended up at a neighborhood basketball court. As we watched the young man play the game, he shared a story about his childhood, about how hard he had to fight just to be able to play basketball in the open without harassment. I remembered the look in his eyes, the sadness, the disappointment. He placed his hand on my heart and encouraged me to step outside of the examination room and walk a mile in the community. That experience had changed my trajectory and my practice. Ultimately, it had propelled me to accept the nomination from the Detroit chapter and step into the role Ace had originated, so that I could make the change needed. Dante agreed with Preston.
If they had, no doubt they would have called us into a private meeting at the event.
I tapped my fingers on the table. And I still can't get over the fact that none of the members of our families are sitting on the board right now. But even as I said it, I knew that was by design. Many of my family members had been deemed too militant, too focused on the struggle. Before I could call it out, Porter did. He was right. The executive board was full of shit. Since all of us were serving in critical roles within our own communities, we had a prime opportunity to do whatever the hell we needed to do. The conversation went on from there, with each of us voicing our concerns and pondering potential changes. Preston cleared his throat.
I wanted you all here because Juneteenth is in less than 4 months, and I think we should make this the most impactful one yet. Change must happen now, not tomorrow, not with the next Mr. Black. Right now is our time, fellas, and we best use it effectively.
As we tossed out ideas, we all resolved to utilize our annual Juneteenth events to target the youth. With a focus on education, we would teach the young black men in our communities to aim high, to seek knowledge, to give back. Whether it was through tech, history, community events, finance, or health. Porter pulled out a fifth of imported whiskey and poured 3 shots for each of us. Tapping the first shot glass on the table, I took it for our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, to pay homage to their vision. The second shot was for my brother Sean, who lost his life far too soon. And the last shot, instead of pouring it on the floor, I tossed it back for the brothers who died in and for the struggle. As we exchanged ideas, outlined our blueprint for action, I realized it was fate that brought us here tonight. Our forefathers had lit the match. Time and experience had prepared us for this mission. We were all at the same place, at the same time, for a reason.
And despite what everyone else thought about decorum and following the rules of order, we were ready to put our feet on some very stiff necks to make shit happen. Chapter 1. War. Nero. April this year. Detroit, Michigan. Sometimes an end is just the beginning. The death of a loved one. The end of a toxic relationship. Unfortunately, I'd experienced both too many times to name. Tragedy often happened in cycles. Years of bliss, followed by periods of crushing blows. The simple fact of life was there was only 24 hours in a day. Would I spend that precious time wallowing or winning? In everything, every calamity, every disappointment, I had no choice but to dust myself off and figure my shit out. Whether it was making a hard decision, planning a move, or even celebrating the destruction of something harmful to me. The bulldozer crushed the first wall of my childhood home in the Fitzgerald neighborhood near Puritan Street. The local church at the end of the street had partnered with a local construction company to buy up the abandoned houses near their building. Over recent years, there had been a push to rebuild and repurpose several dilapidated properties for families. Up until now, they'd been able to simply gut the properties because the structures were solid. Unfortunately, our old house was the first one they had to demolish. It was bittersweet, watching my mother's house crumble to the ground. While the place held more bad memories than good, it was still hers. She'd worked hard to purchase that home, and we'd had a comfortable life there. Looking at the remains of the house now, it was obvious that the subsequent owners or renters hadn't taken care of it. Before the demolition had started, the contractor allowed me a chance to walk through the home. I had immediately regretted my decision when I'd noticed the destruction inside. Trash littering the floor, glass scattered everywhere. Thieves had stolen the copper piping, the old appliances, and even the toilets out of the house. After I exited the house, the putrid smell still clung to me. I wasn't sure why I even wanted to go inside, but it was something I needed to do. The end of a chapter in my life that felt unfinished. As I scanned the area, I could almost hear the delighted screams of the kids I grew up with and the humming sound of bikes hitting the pavement. We'd spent hours running the street, climbing trees, building forts, shooting hoops, and doing shit that we shouldn't have been doing. The construction crew continued their work as I forced myself back to a happier time in my life. If I concentrated hard, I could recall my mother's voice, the wheeze she always seemed to have, the spray of her inhaler, the sound of her shoes shuffling against the carpeted floor. Back then, I didn't understand why she moved so slow. I never even noticed that she was overweight. She was just Mom. Unfortunately, my mother had never really taken care of herself, smoking a pack of cigarettes every day, eating fried food most days, never exercising, always sitting in front of the television. She didn't monitor her blood sugar levels. She didn't even go to the doctor. And we all paid the price when she passed away in her sleep the day before my 12th birthday. Her death had changed my life in more ways than one. She had no living family, so I was separated from my brothers and sisters. They moved to Flint with their father, and since my dad had already died, Ace brought me to live with him. My phone buzzed in my pocket. When I pulled it out, I frowned at the text from my office. The dean of the medical school had requested that I present my plans for the Juneteenth event at the staff forum this afternoon. The Detroit chapter of the Mr. Black organization had partnered with the Detroit NAACP and other local organizations to put on the annual Juneteenth Jubilee Weekend Festival. I also managed to convince the university to sponsor a health fair on campus as part of the larger Juneteenth event. Several colleagues of mine had already volunteered to manage the booths, provide routine health screening, administer vaccines, perform mini fitness classes, and entertain the youth through interactive games. and the medical school students would be on the ground assisting as well, which would in turn give them valuable experience in the field. I responded to the text, letting my assistant know that I would return to the office shortly to tweak the slide deck I'd used to present my proposal to leadership months ago. With this change, I needed to forego my lunch with Ace and make my way back to campus. I took one last look at my old house before I headed to my car.
"Little nigga."
I stopped in my tracks, turning toward the voice. A man standing across the street waved at me.
"Dr. Bond,"
he called. Eyeing him curiously, I noted his appearance. I couldn't see much from the distance, but I noticed the brown paper bag in one of his hands. Judging by the way he was holding it, I figured he had a bottle of liquor or beer inside of the bag. It had been years since I stepped foot on the block. Most of the punks I'd had beef with back then were long gone, some in jail, some dead, and some who left the hood behind for various reasons. This guy didn't appear threatening, though. And what the hell was he going to do anyway with the construction crew nearby and the plainclothes police officer who'd been watching the activity all morning parked on the corner? I absently patted my side as I veered off my path toward the man. My gun was safe in its holster, as always. Ace had always taught me to be smart and be watchful.
"Don't go looking for a fight, but be ready for one."
His words echoed in my mind as I neared the man. I still couldn't make out his features, but he seemed familiar. The stranger must have sensed my hesitation, so he said,
"It's me, Walter King."
I blinked, stepped back to look at him fully. Sure enough, recognition finally dawned on me.
"Yeah."
Once I made it across the street, I reached out and shook his hand.
"It's been a long time."
Walt smiled, flashing his rotted teeth.
"It sure has. I kept up with you, though. I see Ace sometimes over at the barbershop."
My grandfather made it a point to show up in the community. He attended functions, donated to charities, and posted up at his brother's barbershop every Saturday.
"He's still out there doing his thing," I said. "I keep telling him to slow his ass down."
"Nah, man. He's needed out here."
I studied Walt. Back in the day, he was known as a player. He never went anywhere without his drumsticks. Always kept a girl on his arm. He was older than me, but he was like a big brother to us in the neighborhood. Had taught me how to play Michael Jackson's Billie Jean on the drums. Had even kept me out of serious trouble more than a few times.
"What's good with you?"
Walt scratched the side of his face, drawing my attention to his cracked skin.
"Nothing much. I've been trying to find work, but it's been hard."
I noticed that his eyes were dull, too. I couldn't see his feet because he had on sneakers, but his hands and ankles were swollen. The scar above his right eye seemed to be infected.
"Ace told us that you're in Detroit now."
After my divorce, I accepted a faculty position at Wayne State University. I also moved my practice from Ann Arbor to Detroit.
"I'm over at Henry Ford Health now."
He snapped his fingers.
"That's what Ace said. What made you leave Ann Arbor?"
"My ex-wife," I joked. "Nah, I needed to come back to the city."
"Good. The city needs good doctors."
"Why don't you come and visit me?"
I handed him my business card.
"I can set you up for a physical with one of my colleagues. Maybe have someone look at that wound above your eye?"
He averted his gaze.
"Nah, I'm good."
He rubbed the cut with his thumb, and I cringed inwardly because his hands weren't clean.
"I already had it checked out at the clinic."
I didn't believe him. I wasn't sure what he had going on health-wise, but the unmistakable stench of cracked smoke permeated from his clothes and his skin. I knew the smell well, since my father had spent the better part of his adult life strung out on the drug, until he died of an overdose when I was 8 years old. I also knew the scent would follow me until I took a shower.
"Do you think you could spare a few dollars?"
he asked.
I wanted to grab some nachos from the corner store.
My instinct was to tell him no, because any money I'd give him would likely end up in his drug dealer's hands. But I pulled out a $20 bill anyway. Before I gave it to him, I said, I know it might not seem important right now, but you really need to see a doctor about that cut above your eye. He nodded.
I will. I'll ask my sister to bring me to the hospital to see you.
Good. Again, I didn't believe him. But I sent up a silent prayer for him anyway, and handed him the money. Walt stuffed it in his pockets.
Thanks, Nero. You were always one of the good ones. I always knew you'd do big things.
I swallowed past a hard lump in my throat. Seeing such a talented man succumb to the lure of a substance made me sad and angry.
Take care of yourself, man.
I watched Walt amble away for a few seconds before I finally left. On my way back to my office, I grumbled a curse when my phone rang. When I didn't answer, my ex-wife called again. Then again.
What's up?
I said, finally picking up.
It didn't have to be like this,
Evelyn murmured.
I never wanted a divorce.
Of course you didn't. You just wanted to step out on me whenever you felt like it and spend my money.
You don't have that much money, Nero,
she tossed back.
And you didn't really care who I slept with.
Life was an ongoing lesson. From the moment I'd married Evelyn, I realized that there were some things she was better off not knowing, like the true size of my bank account. She'd always underestimated me, and I'd use that to my advantage when it was time to make my exit.
Did you call to talk about my money?
I asked pointedly.
Can we talk about the house?
It was the same argument we'd had since I filed for divorce. I graciously agreed to let her stay in the house rent-free for several years, as a form of spousal support. Her time was up.
It's a done deal, Evelyn. You knew this day was coming.
Why don't you come over so we can talk?
She whined.
I told you the divorce wasn't the end for us.
I snickered. Oh, it's absolutely over.
What about Nala?
Evelyn and I had married because she was pregnant with my youngest daughter, Nala, who was now 20 years old and attending Howard University.
I talked to her today, I said. She's fine. But Zoe is too, I added.
While Zoe wasn't Evelyn's biological daughter, the two were close.
She told me you two had lunch the other day, so I know you already knew that.
Evelyn muttered a curse. I guess you've made up your mind. I did that 7 years ago when I moved out and filed for divorce. The carnage of our long marriage had only left me with resentment. I hated the fact that I'd even felt like I had no way other than down the aisle. I hated that I'd said those vows, knowing I didn't love Evelyn. I hated that I wasted so much time being married to a woman I couldn't really stand. And I vowed years ago that I wouldn't spend another minute living a life that I didn't want. That was the day I moved out. The divorce was just a formality. Everything about us was wrong, from our philosophies to our taste in food to the way we viewed money and status.
I ran into Dr. Jackson at an event the other day,
she said.
He mentioned trying to woo you back to Michigan medicine.
That wasn't going to happen. I'll see him at the Juneteenth event in a couple of months. I'll be sure to let him know that I'm happy where I am. I sighed. The real estate agent will be by today to put the sign up. Please cooperate with her.
Nero, come on.
I have to go, I told her before disconnecting the call. Immediately, I dialed my real estate agent. Tamala Martin answered on the first ring.
Hi, Dr. Bond. Glad you called. I'm on my way to the house now to set the for sale sign in the yard. I don't expect the house to remain on the market long.
Thanks, Tamala. Let me know if you have any problems with my ex-wife.
Sure thing,
Tamala chirped.
By the way, are you available to meet me for lunch tomorrow? To discuss your current search? I found several...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?